This is Dear Analyst. I'm super excited today to have two guests on the show. This is a first for myself in many different regards. Number one, it's the first time I've had two other, again, guests talking on the show. And also these two guests happen to have their own podcast. So they are podcasting professionals unlike myself. So I'm really excited to have Sean Tiber and Tiber.
Yep.
And Kelly Schuster-Predis on the show. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're excited to be here and talk about this. This is going to be fun.
Yeah. So before we get off into things, want to quickly get a quick intro to both of your backgrounds. If you guys want to just take turns explaining who you are and, you know, your background leading up to today.
Okay. Well, normally the joke is I always say I'm Sean Tiber and I introduce myself as a geeky person, but I'm not going to do that today. I'm Kelly Schuster-Predis, and I am an educator who has taught nationally, internationally. I started off teaching science, so, you know, making my bar graphs and line graphs, you will appreciate, Al, and moved into teaching Python about 4 years ago. I was never a coder. And I became a teacher who codes. And that's part of our premise of our podcast.
Awesome. And I'm Sean Tiber. I'm the other half of the podcast. I'm the coder that teaches. So I spent my whole year, you know, last year working through teaching computer science. But before I was a teacher, I worked in marketing. I worked in IT technology. I've done a lot of data analysis along the way. But I never thought I would be a teacher. And then I found myself in a classroom with Kelly teaching middle school computer science. And the really cool thing about this was, given our very different backgrounds and the places that we came from, teaching and technology and merging that together, we just had these phenomenal conversations about how to teach best and how this, and more importantly, how to get the students to learn best, right? Because we can teach as much as we want, but learning is the actual outcome. So going through these conversations, we thought to ourselves, you know, we should probably record this or like share it with other people. And so we started a podcast about 3.5 years ago, almost 4 years ago now, and have had over 300,000 downloads. We've got people from all over the world that listen to it. And I think Kelly can agree with us. We've gotten far more out of it than we've put into it. The connections we made, the learning that we've been able to have as part of this. And just, I can genuinely say that we have friends now that are in this space teaching and learning and coding. And it's really a lot of fun.
That's great. And I think I don't really have folks on the podcast that are educators of code, of teaching these data literacy skills. And I'm curious, when you first both started teaching in middle school, did you feel like the way you're approaching teaching Python, teaching coding was different from the way the curriculum was being taught at the middle school? I'm sure there are many differences, but I'm curious, what was your experience like when you first started teaching your respective subjects?
I think for me, I've always taught a unique way. I always like to think of myself as a transformational educationalist, a person that's always like forward thinking and pushing the boundaries. And so when Sean was mentoring me on coding, I was kind of mentoring him in that same aspect. But he's also a natural rule breaker, I think, when it comes to of doing things. You know, his whole house is decked out in everything Raspberry Pi, IoT. So he doesn't just take one and go, you know, do one thing here. He goes everything crazy. So that's kind of how I taught in science. Everything was about a natural tendency to break the rules, or how can we break the science concept, or how can we, you know, change our outlooks. And then when we transferred into teaching Python, I would venture to say that we do not teach code the way most computer science teachers teach code. So it's quite interesting. We try to find a lot of topics that apply to kids, and we don't teach everything there is about one single concept. We kind of go in and dig in deep, right, Sean? Add to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the most valuable things that Kelly taught me about teaching is developing that empathy for the learner, the putting yourself in their shoes and trying to experience it for the first time the way that they would. And for me, that was challenging in a lot of ways when it came to learning the technology, because I've been learning technology my whole life. It comes relatively easy to me. So to be able to put yourself in the shoes and see the things that are hard, see the things that the students struggle with, and develop that empathy to understand what they're going through, and then tailor your approach to be able to help them through that. I don't want to take away the struggle, right? That was another important lesson. You don't want to take away that struggle to learn something, but you can kind of smooth it out. You can help like hone down the rough edges on it and make it so that the pathway to get to that acquisition of knowledge and understanding is more straightforward. You know, it may not be shorter and it may not be easy, but we help them get there.
Got it. So the million-dollar question is, what is the best approach for teaching Python and these computer science topics to middle school students who are still trying to figure out like what they like, what they don't like? Curious what you come across as you were teaching in middle school.
It's funny. I was just thinking that, you know, we really honestly look towards the student. And so what we may teach one quarter, it totally mutates the next quarter. But we focus on what makes a connection. And it can be as simple as, oh, you're learning about this physics. Well, have we ever thought about why you have to use a calculator? Why can't we just write a program for it? And we try to make a connection and not let the curriculum get in the way. So for example, if we haven't covered lists yet and we need a problem to do with lists, we're not going to say, oh, wait, we'll cover that in week seven. We'll go, hey, well, listen, here's lists. This works well, and this is how we're going to use it, and this is how we're going to solve this problem, and this is why it's interesting to you. And we kind of go from there, if that makes sense.
One of the things that I would add to that is that middle school students learn with their entire being, right? It's not just their intellectual side or their academic focus. They learn with all of them, their hormones, their emotions, their attention span. And that's something that we as adults tend to forget, right? Because we tend to think of learning very concretely and very individually and professionally, but middle school students learn with their whole being. And so if we can get them excited about it, if we can engage that energy and that enthusiasm and that get them to lean forward in their chair and go, whoa, this is actually really cool, then that's when the amazing things start happening. I think my first year, I had a pair of students that a couple of eighth grade girls that were learning Python for the first time, and they were probably like 4 to 5 weeks in. And I gave them a project where they could use conditional statements, if and else, and branch their program to do different things, and said, okay, now go make a project with us. And they're like, anything we want? I said, sure. And they're like, we want to tell a story with us. I'm like, that's a great idea. Go for it. Let's see what you can do. They came back to me the next day, like 24 hours later, with 800 lines of Python code written that told this elaborate story about adventuring in the jungle with this really handsome guy named Rodrigo. So whatever does it for them, it got them going. And they were the most productive Python coders, probably I hands down, anywhere in the Western Hemisphere that night. They got so much done because they were excited and were learning with their whole being.
Interesting. When I was in high school, I mean, the only computer programming classes that were offered were basically QBasic, and not a lot of people wanted to take computer science. It wasn't like considered like a career, so to speak, back then. And I'm wondering, with the classes you teach or you've taught, like, did you find that there was a lot of demand from students to want to take these classes, or were you trying to like convince people to take classes? What does that dynamic look like these days?
We had the luxury of a mandate. Everyone had to take it.
Oh, okay.
So we didn't have to worry about recruiting people or trying to excite them to come into the room. Our challenge is keeping them excited once they're in, or getting them excited because they have to be there. How are we going to make it worth their while? It's kind of like going to a cafeteria on campus, right? Mm-hmm. Like they have to eat there. You got to make the food taste good, right? Yeah. And not every cafeteria believes that, but we do in the place that we serve.
And I think for the kids, they may not love computer science, but if we focus on the relevancy and the reason why, They should understand a little bit of computer science. It gets them reluctantly sometimes, the ones that don't want to code, it gets them understanding the, hey, listen, I know that this may not be my easiest or favorite subject, but it's really important. I need to learn this. And that's our hopes at the end of out of our 3 years, is that they say, oh crap, I hate it, but I know I have to learn it. And we have a lot of our love of it, but at the same time, we still have those people that might not take in computer science in the future, but they will somehow. We'll get
Right.
them.
You're starting them on their journey, and then eventually they might
Exactly.
find their way. One thing that Sean and I talked about last time was that data literacy is not really present in middle schools and maybe even the broader educational system. And I'm curious how you both have tried to introduce that skill or that mindset perhaps into the students that you teach.
It's like a constant argument for us. People are still teaching math as if like computers haven't been invented. Can't bring
Right.
the calculator in. So we do a lot of introductions. In fact, today it was a basic lesson of using tables. The only course in middle school that actually puts stuff in graphs and tables is science class, and it's only when you actually get to do a lab. And it's kind of sad that kids don't see how you can organize a lot of information and use Python and to put it into granular or put it into a visual form. So we do a lot of that. I love Matplotlib, and we talk about making all these different graphs in Seaborn, and the idea that we have, there's, I don't know how many graphs there are in the Seaborn library, but there's a multitude that I've never even seen if before in my entire life. And they're all used for data science and collecting data. So we try to show students a little pieces here and there and coincide with our curriculum. You want to
Yeah,
add?
and
Got
I
it.
think the thing is it's not really evenly distributed, right? And so I guess it's kind of funny to use a data term when talking about this, but some schools are teaching extremely traditionally, right? Where they have this progression of math concepts. And where does math happen? It happens in the math classroom, right? And occasionally in like physics or chemistry or something like that, you might introduce some math where it makes sense, but really math belongs in the math room. And science-based math or things that are practical belong in the science classroom. And don't even talk to me about putting math or data or anything in social sciences. Like that's just insane, right? And then you have the other end of the spectrum where there are educators and there are schools where this flows a lot more. Those silos, the walls between these subjects are breaking down, and you see kind of a combination across the education system. But we really do need to get to this place where data and data literacy and math is incorporated in other subjects, and those other subjects come back into math and social sciences, right? It's the same reason why, when I was learning a lot of introductory computer science back in college, right? It was really hard to access and wrap my head around because all the concepts used examples with variable names like foo and bar and things that didn't mean anything, right? There's no meaning, there's no context. But if you start to bring in this outside applicability, this relevance, this context for what we're learning, everything becomes richer, right? Like, why wouldn't we look at the Electoral College and voting maps and how people vote and the data and the science behind predicting elections in an AP government class, right? That takes a really dry and boring sort of topic of government structure and turns it into something that's directly relevant to the individual. Let them see themselves in the data. Let them see, oh, this is my congressional district, right? How does my congressional district vote? That makes social sciences better, and it makes math and statistics better.
Yeah, like I think the 538 blog is a great example of how you can mesh politics and all that stuff with, the data visualizations that people have come to love and see in various like news outlets and stuff like that. So when at the beginning of the school year or at the semester, are you having conversations with the math, physics, science teachers about, hey, how we can incorporate Python, Excel or whatever into the curriculum? Because like you said, social sciences, there's a ton of data analysis happening there. Do you have those kind of conversations with other teachers, or is it kind of still like very siloed?
It depends, right? It depends on the time of year that you ask, because right now everything's so dramatic and with teachers, and there is a lot of work placed on the teachers. I think pre-COVID, we were very good at getting into the classrooms. We did a lot of things with, you know, probability, looking at data collected from what are they called? The race cars.
Oh, the we had
dragsters.
Dragsters, yep. CO2 dragsters, yep.
Dragsters, collecting the and analyzing the mass and the speed and plotting that quickly in Matplotlib, and we're talking about 150 points of data, which for an eighth grade student, that's a lot of information. We're not talking like big data sets, but it was kind of nice. I think after or during COVID, things got hectic. And there's been a lot more silo action going, but that was due to the pandemic and for not being able to collaborate as much. And I feel like the journey is starting to pick up again, and we're starting to talk about areas where ethical implications apply in foreign languages class, not so much about data analysis, but talking about how we can use AI to have the actors mouths change and they actually speaking in the language of that country, so that these things are happening. It just happens. It's a spur of the moment kind of thing right now.
Yeah. And I would say like probably our best engagements have come not from a formal meeting where we talk about like, okay, everybody sit down and we're going to talk about how we're going to include data in all of these lesson plans. It's usually happening over lunch or over coffee when we're saying, hey, what do you plan? You know, what are you working on next? What are you teaching next? And we get the teacher to talk about what they're doing with their lesson plan, and we offer to come in and help, right? And so, you know, some teachers are very, very welcoming of that help. They want you to come in like, yeah, you want to teach a lesson for me about data and integrate it into the overall plan that I'm doing? That's great. I'm welcome. Come on in. Other teachers, they kind of want to do it their way. And we kind of like, just, you know, we're persistent. We offer the help. And when they're ready, they'll come back to us.
Got it. Yeah, one, I sent this to you both. The one podcast episode I constantly think back to, and I reference this all the time, is this Freakonomics episode number 391. It's called America's Math Curriculum Doesn't Add Up. And the whole kind of point of this episode was the Freakonomics team, they hired a professor or something to do a bunch of research on their audience. And they basically found that everyone took algebra, geometry, trigonometry, calculus in middle school and high school. But then the ones that said they continue to use those topics or those skills in their professional lives was like, you know, less than 2% or something. And so then they did another survey asking, well, what do you use in your day-to-day work? And it's things like Excel, Google Sheets, data analysis, data visualization, how to tell a story with data. And these are skills that we don't teach or don't often teach, I think, in most schools. And so this got me to thinking about if we completely over-index on teaching kids what they will need to actually have in the workplace, we could end up just teaching them Excel, Google Sheets, you know, data analysis, how to create PowerPoint presentations all day long. But then is there an argument for also having the traditional social studies, physics, calculus? I'm curious where you to kind of lean on that debate, if you will, of like, do we just prepare kids primarily for being able to work like in a 9-to-5 job, or what is the value of having these other subjects like trigonometry and calculus?
Ah, now you've hit on one of our favorite discussion topics.
Please, like, let me know what you think.
Kelly, ladies first, go ahead.
Oh, you're so sweet. Well, obviously that race to calculus really irritates Sean and I. I think I can speak for him. I was one of those students who thought I was going to be pre-med, and I took Calc 3. One, I can't remember anything about Calc. And two, I never had statistics. So when Sean and I are trying to do statistical stuff with Python, I'm like, what does it mean to do the mean and the mean? You know, I don't know simple things like that. What a waste of my time. I'm just going to say that first. but yes, there are not many schools, and I think a lot of the issues come from like the AP College Board does not really test for data science. Therefore, one that's not even really thought about in many schools right now. However, I do agree that you still need to have your Englishes, your histories, your art histories, your extracurricular stuff, because that's what makes that whole child. And if you're not able to make connections with external things or put together the bigger picture, it's useless just to know facts about how to analyze data, because you can read data for what it is, but you won't be able to infer much if you don't have a greater understanding of this other subject areas. So if that makes sense, I would love to see more data science, more understanding of these concepts, these big ideas from data, but I wouldn't teach directly towards the career aspect, because it's mm-hmm. you're not getting the full picture of that person or that career person, you know.
Well, I would add to that. I mean, there's a tremendous amount to unpack here. I mean, entire mm-hmm. books, like whole sections of the library have been written about this. And I think to Kelly's point, and I've spent some time in my career working in higher education for adult learners, primarily on the marketing side, not actually as an educator. But a lot of our marketing was really pitched around helping adult learners get jobs or get better jobs, right? That really practical, pragmatic, you know, go get something that will change your life for the better. It wasn't designed to be something that enriched your life with more knowledge of subjects that were non-professional. That being said, there is a balance to be struck, and it's different at different times in your life. Certainly for younger people, there's the need to educate the whole child. For older people, maybe the demand is more for pragmatic, marketable skills that I can use to land a better job. But you know, that doesn't mean we stop teaching art classes to adults, right? There should always be the offering, and there should always be the opportunity to include all of these things, because, you know, as a computer science teacher, right, as a STEM teacher, I love art, I love music, I love dance, I love all those things because my students love it, right? If they love it, and I can work with that to help them enhance both their interests and their understanding of computer science, then we've won, right? Like, that's a great thing. So I definitely see, you know, the math side of things where we've taught in a fairly traditional way for a long time as having value. Like, there is value in the way that we structure the math curriculum, and it is effective at teaching the things that we intend for it to do. But there are also some unintended consequences of the structure, this castle that we've built for ourselves of math, where the race is to get to calculus. And I think we've done such a great job of getting students to, you know, pass that calculus AB exam, you know, that AP Calc exam in high school, or to pass the course in college with calculus, that we've stopped asking, why are we teaching them calculus? Like, why calculus? What are they going to use it for? And it has this consequence that if students aren't good at learning math within that structure that we've built, they tend to devalue themselves, right? There's a sense that if I'm not good at math, I'm not smart. And that's just baloney. Like, I mean, I'm keeping it G-rated, but it's not okay that we've created this this structure that makes kids feel dumb because they don't understand calculus. That makes no sense to me. And I was someone who was reasonably good at calculus, but I've also felt dumb in the calculus class, right? Does that mean I'm not a smart person? No, it just means I didn't understand that part, right? So as we look at math, what I think we really should be asking is, what are we really trying to teach our students? What do we really want them to learn? And it's the same thing I would argue from computer science. What do we really want them to learn? Do I really want them to learn Python or Pandas or Excel or Google Sheets? Not particularly. What I really want them to learn is how to figure things out, how to research, how to like gain knowledge, how to learn, right? How to be persistent, how to find another solution to the problem, how to ask for help appropriately. And those are all things that you could learn in a calculus class. You can learn them in a statistics class, geometry, linear algebra. Like, those are all great vehicles for learning those skills and those traits. But so I think that brings us to the question, why calculus? Why are we focusing on this sequence and structure? And to be fair, I'm not a math teacher, and I don't have a PhD in math education or anything like that. So there's probably people who would come up here and, you know, vociferously argue with me the opposite point. But I think the question is the right question. Are we still teaching the right things to our students? And is it still leading to the right outcomes for the learner that we want them to have? Or is it just something that helps them get a five on the AP Calc exam so that they can get into college, so they can go do something that they really want to do?
Yeah. I think that brings up another important topic, which is teaching towards the exam. I remember when I took, you know, AP English or AP Physics, it was all about how do I get that four or five on the exam? And I took the AP Computer Science exam, and I remember that was in C++. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, these basic computer science questions about C++, you know, do you understand loops and all that kind of stuff? But I'm curious if you had a magic wand and you could reformat the AP Computer Science exam to better test a student's ability to problem solve, be curious, all those skills that you can learn in other subjects. How would the college board, if you were the college board, how would you edit that test? I'm curious.
That's so funny. Before you answer that, Sean, I want to do this shout out first for this website Al made by Stanford. It's called UCubed, and I'll send you the link, but it's a UCube data science for K-12. And the way that, and we're talking K, five-year-olds, six-year-olds learning data science.
Wow.
And you know, one of the worksheets you might see is you have these different size circles. And inside this different size circles, you have a picture of a fruit because these kids can't read at that age. And then you have on the bottom, the size circles from least to greatest. And the question is, put this in order. You know, what is the most popular fruit or what is the least popular fruit just by a visual understanding? So at 5 years of age, kids are being taught how to problem solve with minimal amount of vocabulary. So if you can imagine transferring that into a computer science AP class, regardless if they use Python, because right now it's JavaScript, right, Sean?
It depends on the level.
Depending on the level, they have a language. But why a specific language? Well, because teachers can't teach all the language. But what if it was an open language? What if it was, here's this problem, and how would you solve this? Even if you didn't know a language, what would you do? What is your pseudoscript? How would you go about thinking through the ordered pairs or the ordered procedure for solving a problem? For me, that's a skill that's super hard for everyone. Like, where do we start? Where do we go? Regardless if I use Excel or regardless if I use Python or whatever, where do I start? For me, that's where I think like the college level SAT APs need to go to start with, is like that problem solving, critical thinking concept of an open-ended question. The problem is people can't grade that. It's too much. Mm-hmm. It's too much, right, to get through.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's important to note with the computer science exams in particular, and as you start to talk about computer science courses, is that computer science is a discipline, right? It's an academic discipline that has specific things that we're talking about. It's the study of computation, right? It's not anything with a coding language in particular. And so as we think about what is the AP computer science exam, it may not actually look that much different than what it is today, because what it does is assess your knowledge of the field of computer science, right? But what I think we're recognizing and we're starting to see more and more of is that computer science is not the same as solving problems with code or making things using technology. That, yes, you need to understand some computer science concepts, but it's so much broader than that, or can be applied to so many other areas. So, I mean, I almost want to turn your question a little bit on its head and say, in addition to the AP computer science exams, what exams should we be offering, right? Or what other ways, more specifically, do we show colleges or employers that students know how to do certain things, right? That they will be successful, like that the outcome of this task that the student does or this thing that they perform is a good indicator of their ability to succeed at the next level, right? And that's what I think the AP exam is always intended to do. It's there to show competency and the ability to be successful. So what more can we add to that? And this is where, if a student comes to me for advice about what they can do to kind of engage their knowledge and their space of coding and technology and how to make that more attractive for colleges and universities, my advice to them is always come up with something that's a portfolio. Show me some projects, do some things on the side that apply what you've learned, and do the AP computer science exam, right? Because then you can show the college that you're applying to, I know how to take a test. I've demonstrated knowledge of these topics and I understand them really well. And also I've applied that in a really unique and creative world that's made the world a little bit better, right? It's not just I got a 5 on the exam. It's I made this thing and it improved people's lives or made my life better or it solved a problem. I think that's tremendously attractive for, you know, K-12 students trying to get to whatever that next level is.
100%. Yeah. Same thing when people ask me about getting a role as a, you know, entry-level data analyst or something. First thing I say is it's create an online portfolio. It's super simple to create a website these days. You can go on Kaggle or some other website and find these really rich data sets and just do some exploratory data analysis, put your findings online and write a blog post about it maybe. And these are all things that recruiters, employers can publicly see and gives you kind of like a visual, like resume, if you will, that other applicants may not have.
Yeah, I think that kind of gets to one of the fallacies, right? Of the, at least in the minds of students, they think that they are their SAT score or their AP score, right? And basically what we've done is taken a complex, unique individual with lots of skills and traits and unique abilities, and we've binned them down to one of 5 possible numbers, right? 4 possible, 5 possible, whatever, right? 5 possible numbers. Oh, you got a 5, you're a 4. And we've reduced that data about them down to something that doesn't actually tell us that much, if you think about it, right? Does it tell you how likely they are to pass their freshman, you know, computer science class, right? Does it tell you the quality of the projects that they're going to create or their ability to solve problems or their ability to have a conversation with another human being and understand from that other human being something that needs to be done and created? Like a 5 doesn't tell me that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But weirdly enough, I read somewhere and I can't remember where, I'm always do this to Sean, but I was reading about the SAT and how it's actually starting to change. And so you notice, and rightly so, because your big schools that do data science, Berkeley, you know, CMU, MIT, Cornell, all those big schools that are top for data science, they're pushing for the SAT to actually show some sort of score versus the APs, because the APs haven't changed. There's not many APs to offer for math and science. I think there's like 5. But the SAT is now starting to incorporate a lot of data science in their literacy questions as well. So it'll be an interesting perspective as long as the colleges start pushing for this educational movement, because K-12 won't change until the colleges force and the AP board force the K-12s to change. So,
yeah, totally. I know I want to start wrapping things up here and I want to kind of shift gears a little bit into the podcast, Teaching Python. Awesome, amazing podcast. I'm curious, what episodes do you feel like have resonated the most with your audience, with students, educators, the whole gamut?
It's funny because I was looking last night at our top, I like to look at the numbers, talking about data. I go and I look at the top. Obviously, our top one is still the first episode of Hello World, which is just brutally hard for me to listen to.
So awkward.
But a lot of ours that resonate, our video conference podcast episode with Real Python Chris Bailey, how to make a video, was really huge, and it continues to be huge because I think people are still shifting and understanding that video is important. But I don't know which one. What is the other one? Will Richardson, educational reform, and how we really need to start thinking about learning and how it's different than schooling. So the kids come to school and they are schooled to learn this. And this is kind of goes in line with our conversation versus the fact that kids are always learning. There's been no learning lost in COVID. You know, my kids may not have been doing math facts with 20 million math worksheets, but they did learn how to use a drill and build a tiki bar and build some tables, and they were learning something. So I think that episode really resonated with a lot of people. Sean?
I mean, for me personally, I think the episode with Barbara, with Barbara Oakley was really, really powerful. So Barbara Oakley is a professor of engineering, but she has written a number of books about the way that we learn and the way that we acquire information and the way that we learn most effectively. And it was really fascinating to me the way she brought together all the different aspects of this, the way that we practice skills, the way we practice acquiring knowledge, as well as incorporating the theoretical into that. And she goes all the way down to the brain physiology, right? The way that our brain processes and integrates the information and stores it in memory was just phenomenal. And it really changed the way that I think about the way I learn, but also the way I help others learn, the way I structure the lessons, the way I structure the homework, the practice, all of those things really make a big difference. And it's been kind of interesting because I've actually not been teaching for the last 3 to 4 months. I've been out of the classroom. I took a new role working back in technology, one of those, like, I have to do it. It's a once in a lifetime sort of opportunity. And I'm having a blast doing it, but I miss the teaching. So we're bringing in summer interns. I'm putting together the curriculum plan for them. I've got lessons ready to go. Like, we've got stuff that we're planning for them because I love that process of helping others learn, because I learn along the way too. And I think Barbara really brought that to kind of the fore for me. It really helped me understand why I enjoy learning so much.
Oh, we can't miss. We're going to air a new episode coming out in the next couple of weeks from a gentleman who worked with Papert and talked about computational thinking. And that is going to be a new favorite of mine, I think, once we air that one. So that was fun.
Yeah, that one should come out in a couple of weeks. The other one that was really good too, from a different perspective, was with Elena Aguilar, talking about equity in the classroom and how we make learning more equitable so that it's not just available and accessible to the students who have all of the right tutors and support and resources. It's how we make learning more equitable to everyone. And I think that was a lot of food for thought. Like, what are we really doing? And to be honest, it's one of the reasons why we have kept the podcast going for as frequently as we have, as long as we have, is because we recognize that we are in a very, we're very grateful for the position we have to be able to learn how to teach this, how to help others learn. And we want to share that as broadly as possible. So the real reason our podcast is there is because we know that there are a lot of teachers who don't have the resources we do. They don't have the colleagues that we do that they can talk to and say, hey, I'm trying to teach this concept in computer science, or I'm trying to think about this thing. What do you think? They don't have anyone to talk to. And so we've made the podcast a place for them to sit in on the conversation with us every couple of weeks and hopefully grow their knowledge and understanding a little bit, and share some of our learning and resources with them.
Very cool. And I'll include links to all the different episodes and the guests that you mentioned in the show notes. One last question is, where do you hope to take the podcast, like, in the next year, 3 years? Given that, you know, Python and coding it's a pretty visual thing. I'm curious if you've thought about getting into the whole, like, YouTube game. I know Free Code Camp does a lot of, like, YouTube videos now. Where do you think you'll take the show down the road?
Before you answer this, funny story, just 2 days ago, the sixth grader's like, Miss, we just liked your YouTube channel. You should totally not make it private. We can, like, advertise on it. And then I said, oh my gosh, the worst thing I need to hear is my voice. And I'm sure Sean too, because he edits all our podcasts. So I'm in his head constantly. But I know there's a lot of opportunity for YouTube, but there's also, for me, I just like being spoiled and meeting amazingly smart people around the world and just learning from them. That's, like, my main goal for the podcast. I know, Sean, we have a lot of other plans, so I'll let him explain some more.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, really, when it comes to video and other offerings, what we want to do is be something unique in the space, offer something that no one else is. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to learn Python that are going to be far superior to what we can do, right? Like, we're pretty good teachers, but there are some amazing resources out there, amazing teachers, and it's already out there. So I think the real question for us is, what can we offer that is unique and different? And some of that may be not teaching to students, but teaching to the teachers, right? Helping other computer science teachers with maybe some of the things that they're struggling with or they don't quite understand yet, or just helping them get there sooner. So that's sort of the focus that we've had in our planning for the next year is what kinds of things can we offer that are core to who we are and what we do really, really well. Because in a world of the infinite choice of the internet, it almost becomes more important to hyper focus on something that no one else is doing than to try to be everything to everybody.
Right. Yeah. Teachers teaching other teachers. I love that that angle or niche, if you will. Well, Sean, Kelly, I want to thank you so much. I've taken up a lot of your time today. And is there anything else that you want to mention or talk about before we sign off for the episode?
The only thing I was going to plug was just that we have a couple of speaking engagements coming up over the next couple of weeks, and maybe they'll be out by the time the episode goes live. But we're speaking at PyCon US for the first time, which is happening at the end of April, early May. And so we're speaking, we have two topics, actually. One is about busting curriculum myths, and it's in the education summit part of the conference. So hopefully that will be on YouTube. And then we're also speaking at the main conference on learn Python like a 12-year-old. So kind of talking about that concept that I mentioned earlier about learning with your whole being and all the things that we've forgotten about learning when we became adults and why learning new things is actually fun and interesting and empowering.
Awesome. Learn with your whole being. I think that's a good kind of a sign off quote for the show. Well, Sean, Kelly, thank you so much for your time. And hopefully we'll have you two back on the show sometime in the future.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.